I do need to wrap my 20 off.
I will go as fast.
We'll go as fast as you can.
Okay, here we go again.
I'm Kirk Bailey. I'm formerly the Chief Information Security Officer for the City of Seattle, and that's primarily the reason Ed invited me to be here today. And I invited along Ernie, my colleague, who is the Chief Information Security Officer from Port of Seattle. My current position is now here at the University of Washington, trying to introduce the same kind of function here at the university environment. Anyway, Ernie and I are going to be talking about the view of what it takes to manage and protect critical infrastructure. And I'll let Ernie talk quickly about the agenda.
Yeah, my job is to hold the pen, so thanks, Kirk. So what we want to do is we'll talk about how big the job is for us and also appreciate and help explain to you that it's not all bits and bytes every day. And, in fact, I was talking to Steve earlier. He's not in the room, but he asked me what our days were like, and they're really quite fascinating. So we're going to talk about the size of the job, scope, how involved it is, what our challenges are, and also give you a sense of kind of the broad perspective that we have for every day on our jobs, and then maybe what our future looks like, as well as what your future would look like if you decide to come in this profession.
I'm going to go through this real quickly, but I wanted to give you a little context to understand how big the problem is of critical infrastructure protection and the underpinning of the IT technology that's there, the information technology that's underneath it. And the reason I want to go quickly through these slides is to give you a sense of all that's involved if you're trying to manage your corner of the piece of critical infrastructure. I want to give you an idea. Just start looking at the numbers. One of the ones that stand out for me is 87,000 different localities and jurisdictions involved in critical infrastructure at the governmental level. Now, to me, that's an important figure to understand, because in order for me to win the politics and economics of wars and battles that take place as chief information security officers for competition for federal dollars, I have to compete with those localities. And critical infrastructure requires protection requires a chief information security officer for any of those localities to try and manage the best political position. And it's an interesting environment when you start looking at all the different kinds of competition, the extent of critical infrastructure that's there. There's another slide here I'd like you to see with this. And what's interesting about this that you'll see in a minute is that Ernie and I own a piece of everything that's listed up here, which makes the Seattle area a very unique piece of critical infrastructure in this country's total picture.
So, sorry, to be clear about this, what this means is that the city of Seattle owns its own water system, for example.
Yes, we're going to get into that.
And its own power system.
We're going to talk about the interface.
The city of Seattle is a petri dish. We're a very unique entity. New York buys its power from Con Ed. The city of Seattle owns the ninth largest publicly owned hydroelectric power company. The ninth largest public power company, which involves the ownership of dams and power generation systems and all the incredible grid that has to be associated with that. So, and we own lots of other things, which makes it a unique petri dish and of interest at the national level. Let's talk a little bit about the city of Seattle. I was just starting to go through that. I also want to point out something very interesting in terms of economy, in terms of budgets. The city of Seattle's operating budget is about $2.5 to $2.7 billion. About $660 million of that comes from the tax base. The other $2 billion comes from the ratepayers, from the utilities, from the garbage bills, from the power and electric bills, from the water supply bills, from the sewer bills. What's interesting is sitting in the middle of the city of Seattle, all its critical infrastructure is the University of Washington, which is a $3 billion operating budget, more than the entire city of Seattle and what it has to protect. It's a very interesting I thought it was an interesting problem, which also has another interesting financial situation. It only gets about, 550 billion, or 11% of its budget from the state, and the rest comes from grants, contracts, and other sources, endowments. When you talk about the city of Seattle, you think of it as just having these borders. This is basically the city limits. The truth is the city's critical infrastructure stretches across the state. It is integrated in with a whole network of critical infrastructure systems throughout the United States. We started with the power generation company. We have dams scattered across the state of Washington, and its power grid is integrated with the Bonneville Power Administration and the Canadian Power Grids. The city of Seattle's trading system is critical in the operation of the ebb and flow of power in this region. And the management of that is absolutely critical. And that whole trading system is IP-based, Windows-based application technology. And that's a very interesting set of challenges to manage that particular infrastructure. Seattle also owns massive, I think Seattle's assets, if you had to add it up, are close to $2 trillion in assets. That's because it owns dams. It owns massive swaths of land for its water reservoir systems. It owns pipelines and a whole array of infrastructure that is extensive. City of Seattle feeds water to 17 other municipalities, about 1.5 million other people. Same with power. We feed the power to roughly 2 million people in the state, and we are really the primary, the city of Seattle is the primary engine of infrastructure for the state economy in terms of, if you look at the percentages of the businesses that rely on its critical infrastructure. It owns a huge transportation system, including alternative routes on the northbound and southbound routes on the freeways, I-5 corridor. It owns critical bridges, transportation systems that have complex traffic control systems and monitoring systems and surveillance systems for traffic congestion monitoring and control that are critical and are also an interesting source of attack potential. It has the largest police force, the largest fire department. It has the largest deployment of parks, recreational services. It has the largest municipal health department that's critically integrated into the CDC's response plans. It has a massive licensing service, business service set of agencies. It has a whole host of services that are really unrecognized by those of us who use them. Another important infrastructure which is problematic is the sewer system and the water takeaway, water disposal systems. That turns out to be a very interesting source of potential problems as a critical infrastructure for the city. So when you think of the city of Seattle, don't think of just the boundaries of the city limits. Think of it as spread across the state and integrated into the nation's infrastructure. And the blessing for the city is those of us who've worked for the city were able to capture an awful lot of interesting federal attention because of the uniqueness of the city. He talked about an ISAC, a siloed bit of financial services. The truth is, those ISACs, our reporting structures that the government set up and private sector responded to, and local agencies like us responded to channel communications about information related to attacks and potential problems. As the CIS over the city of Seattle, I had no less than 7 ISACs I had to report through and operate with, and they were lethargic and unusable. They were great sources of historical data and reporting tools, but they were not very well, they didn't have much usefulness in terms of instant response and strategic planning. And that is the basis, by the way, of the entire federal plan for IT protection and critical infrastructures, the use of these silo-type structures. Now I'll let Ernie talk a little bit about the port.
Okay, so for the Port of Seattle, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, we are a government agency separate from the city of Seattle. And we are essentially a small city. We have our own fire department, our own police department. We have essentially, we run parallel for about 32 miles with the city of Seattle. And our impact on the economy is, the numbers are up here, 160,000 jobs generated. We're only about 1,400 employees. $5.5 billion in payroll, taxes, revenue, impacts. And essentially, like I say, we are a small city. We have a park system and so forth. Now, just before I proceed, give you a sense of what my job is every day. I have 4 topical areas that are pretty much always on my list. Number 1 is information security, not IT security. That's an element, but information security. And I think it was shown quite well in the previous discussion, too. Number 2 is business continuity, disaster recovery planning. It's a huge issue for us, and it's getting bigger every day because of all the databases and all the different things we do with our customers and so forth. Number 3 is privacy issues, and number 4 is critical infrastructure protection. So if you look at this at the Port of Seattle, we are essentially a bunch of bullseyes all stacked up together on a map. We have an airport, obviously. We manage the airport and the seaport collectively. And the airport, even though, for example, the airlines might have their own particular issues relative to communications and so forth internal to their companies, we still provide a lot of the infrastructure for them. And also, in some cases, they're actually not necessarily on our network, but on an operations network that we allow for them to be used. Got a couple slides here to show our terminals for containers and so forth, and it's really strictly to give you a sense of how big this is. I mean, we have, in this slide alone, down at Terminal 5, the size is many acres, obviously. We have rail traffic that's on there for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. We have truck traffic on there. We have a series of, obviously, we handle about almost 2 million containers a year. And also, you can see there's a list of different companies aligned on the right-hand side that are basically our tenants. Everything ranging from the different lines that come in, Matson and so forth. And these are the people who come in and park, use our cranes, drop off the containers and so forth. And they have expectations from us to provide a selective amount of infrastructure, the invisible infrastructure, as I call the IT, to support them in the communications. And again, just a couple more shots. This is Terminal 46. We also are working closely with Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which is one of the largest rail yards in the West Coast. And Terminal 91, which is home for a lot of fishing fleet and also a lot of future development. But the big issue is that our trade alone, the impact, is about almost $24 billion here in the area. And this is huge. So if the port doesn't work, the trade doesn't work. And if the trade doesn't work, there's a lot of issues. One of the element too is on cruise ships. Kirk and I had the chance to go up to Vancouver and talk to the CIOs up there for the Port of Vancouver. And it was an interesting discussion. First of all, they were irritated that we stole a lot of their cruise ship traffic. But the other aspect is that the cruise ships are almost, if you will, any one time, the highest concentration of U.S. citizens outside of the United States, usually on a density basis. And if you can think of it in terms of maybe a World Trade Center lying on the side, it's a wonderful opportunity for a terrorist attack. And the people in Vancouver were petrified about this for quite a while because they had all these American citizens up there, and as problems started arising, they were worried about that. Well, we handle about 650,000 passengers a year. We are increasing our cruise ships next year to about almost 200 different sailings. The fact of the matter is, again, there's an expectation for our customers, the cruise ships, that we provide security, we provide services, and so forth. We also have a grain terminal, recreational marinas, the largest fisherman's terminal for the Pacific Northwest Fleet, and we also manage 17 different parks. So even though it's not necessarily on my radar screen to worry about whether the grass is mowed or not at the park, we're still worried about some of the issues relative to infrastructure. This map is really trying to, Kirk and I have used this previously, and we've talked about how the city and the port interface. Our borders are immediately adjacent to each other. For example, in the seaport area alone, we don't have our fire department there. We only have it at the airport, so we rely on the city's fire department. Well, the city's fire department also relies on strong communications with us, 800 megahertz radios, 450 megahertz, and so forth. As far as some other shared services, just to give you a sense of the infrastructure that we look at, power. Seattle City Light was providing power to the port as well as Puget Sound Energy. Sewer, same issue with City of Seattle, King County. Water, telecom, huge issue. Quest, Singular, AT&T, Nextel. The Westin Building, if you're not familiar with that, is a carrier hotel. It's a huge issue, and it's one that Kirk and I would also both worry about if we lost it, even in his role here at UW.
Right. There's something I'd like to point out about that. One of the key telecommunications assets the city of Seattle has is right-of-way on its streets. We learned in New York City after the World Trade Center disaster that right-of-way on streets was the easiest way to deploy a temporary infrastructure to reestablish telco. And the city of Seattle and other municipalities that have these right-of-ways are tempted to create interesting negotiated settlements with different telecommunications providers and regions about who has priority for the land of the cables. And part of the infrastructure protection, which does get some attention related to IT, is the interest of how fast the city can recreate services by using the right-of-way.
And unfortunately, think about the right-of-way might be destroyed if it was a major earthquake or whatever because of the viaduct collapsing and other things like that. Just to continue to show the shared services, transportation, a huge issue, especially for us as a port, because we're trying to move containers in and out. And I think if you've taken a good close look at the post-Katrina event down in New Orleans, one of the issues they had is they got their port finally got up, but they couldn't move the trucks because the roads were all blocked. So those are issues that we worry about a lot. Pipelines, other issues, aviation fuel transport, just to give you a sense of interdependencies, a couple years ago there was a break in the Olympic pipeline down in Renton. It was for a test line about the size of my small finger. Spilled about 300,000 gallons of some ridiculous amount of fuel. They finally isolated it, but they had to close the pumping station for about a week so they could put the new line on, hydrostatically test it, and so forth. Well, the airport almost ran out of fuel because they couldn't get the fuel through the pipeline into the airport, and the airlines were starting to be told they may have to divert to either Portland or Vancouver to refuel before they took off on any major international flights.
I want to mention something about the water pipelines as well. Seattle owns this massive water pipeline system, and what's interesting about that is during simulations we're going to be talking about later, simulated terrorist attacks, it turns out that pipeline systems and their control aspects, their functional control requirements, have a wide spectrum of interesting vulnerabilities that engineers are quite worried about. Water supply pipelines turn out to be a very interesting potential target set.
And by the way, the last line, but not least, is information systems. It's a huge issue for all of us. And when Kirk and I were doing some discussions about the city and the port, we looked at some combined numbers. And, you know, this doesn't include the University of Washington, which would just, you know, totally skyrocket some of these numbers. But desktops, laptops, numbers of servers, network peripherals, radios. Radio's a huge issue. Again, look at Katrina. Katrina had tons of problems with 800 megahertz collapsing. Unfortunately, a lot of it had to do with no chargers or no batteries for the 800 megahertz, but the fact is that's a key issue here in the Seattle area.
One of the things that's interesting, this points to politics, most of the city of Seattle, and the ports for that matter, critical infrastructure reinforcement that has come from federal grants, what are called Urban Area Security Initiative grants, UASI grants. The Department of Homeland Security has issued about $144 million worth of grants to the local region. Much of the dollars that goes towards IT stuff, over the course of 2 years, I submitted almost $4 million worth of grant requests specific to cybersecurity, and I was granted only a tiny percentage of that. But a lot of the money was going towards infrastructure protection for 800 megahertz radio systems and fortifying those kinds of deployments. So there is some money coming in on some emphasized areas. But this is first responder stuff, which was mentioned before.
Yeah, and we have the same issue at the port. I've applied for money for cyber issues and cybersecurity support, and we've not spent any money at the port for any cybersecurity.
And what we mean by unique specialized information systems, for instance, you're seeing some of these unique systems the city has deployed that go straight to their financial situations, those the new parking meters, those new wireless parking meters that you see deployed. As a chief information security officer, that actually turns up being a piece of critical infrastructure, and all 1,600 of them are going to be deployed in the city. I know how they're secured. I know the pattern of the way they're being deployed. I understand who manufactures them. I know what technology is in them. I just wanted to mention that when you're a security person working for a large enterprise, especially like a city, you end up working on lots of strange different kinds of technology deployments. Other types of things are lots of unique surveillance systems that are deployed throughout the critical infrastructure to ensure that security is being enforced. There's some interesting mobile data terminals that are deployed in fire trucks and in police cars that have unique characteristics about them in terms of what their security requirements are. So there's a whole bunch of unique specialized stuff. It isn't just servers, desktops, and routers on networks.
And again, I think if you look at the state law for 6043, which is the same as the California 1386, take a good hard look at that law and start realizing that almost half of these things up here may contain personal information, and that can ruin your whole day when one of those devices is either lost or stolen, like a Trio. You know, it's got a bunch of data in it, gets stolen, it was an executive, well now what do I do with it?
This is probably the most important point I can make about information security related to critical infrastructure. I was trained in a commercial environment, in a financial institution, my security skills. When I arrived at the city, I had, in the health services industry, I worked for a large insurance company as their chief information security officer. When I arrived at critical infrastructure, most of what I knew about protecting networks, data, and systems, it was useful, but it was not applicable. The politics of critical infrastructure protection and the politics of the money associated with that and the different functional things you have to protect is a whole different set of requirements for security. So you have to think very differently about security when you think about critical infrastructure. And I can guarantee you, if you're a super geek and you know your networks, you got a hand up in terms of understanding some of the rudimentary things, but you do not know enough. And we're going to try and tell you how much extra stuff you have to know beyond technology to properly play the game of critical infrastructure protection. This is a real important slide for us. We tried to chart, I think Forrester Research tried to talk about this, the problem with the security industry, and most of the vendors in the security industry, and I'm constantly at war with the security vendors, I just don't like talking to Band-Aid dealers, is that their focus is largely on this. And you started touching on other business requirements that are in the information security, but most people think that security can be found in solving technology problems. The truth is that's a very important element, but security and critical infrastructure is 90% people and 10% technology. The business problem of critical infrastructure is an enormous one of managing the security for it. And it quickly migrates from business problems into very sophisticated and odd new realms for those people who are not involved in security, in critical infrastructure security, which is in this area of critical strategies, critical security problems, which gets into understanding regional interests and nation-state interests and the intelligence you have to have in order to manage the threats to the region as well as the localized threats. And we're going to get into some of those kinds of thinking so you can see the extent and the knowledge base you have to acquire and some of the tools you have to acquire for yourself to be a critical infrastructure defender. But this hopefully captures for you the sense of how much more is involved in security. And most of the problem I have now in the security area is that the research is not focusing on things I need and need desperately, especially critical infrastructure. There's some in forensics and investigations, but there's very little in intelligence gathering. You're doing some. There's hardly any work being done in the intelligence gathering and organized cybercrime, which is actually more important than some of these other areas in technology. There's very little work being done on contract work and legal issues associated with alliances you have to have. So there's new issues with legal interests that have to be researched. And we need to create technology rules and translate the legal issues into technology deployment. So this area still remains important. But a lot of the critical research that needs to be done to protect critical infrastructure isn't being done.
Yeah, and I think Kirk and I have discussed too is that most of the time, if we were to look at this chart, we're usually from the first line on the left to the right, all the way across. Most of the time, for example, at the port, I'm relying on the infrastructure people to handle the firewalls and the intrusion detection and so forth. That's not the issue, per se. It's usually the complaint about, well, what do we do about SB 6043? What do we do about this particular issue relative to a potential hacker? What do we do about this employee that lost their Trio? What do we do about alliances that might have some question marks for us relative to their security implications? And especially with being the port, where we're international in flavor, it's pretty fascinating because we also have the Chinese are a very major player for us on trade, but also there's some issues relative to are they trying to attack us or not from an external hacker.
I wanted to bring up the area of intelligence again because I'm going to be talking about cyber criminal organizations and what we know about them and why it's so much different as a security tool or a security practice now, why it's so important. In critical infrastructure, you cannot sit around and wait for the next worm or virus. You have to actually try and get out there and anticipate where they're coming. And you have to also start to know what tools are being used because the attacks are so numerous and there's so much going on. You have to be able to create specialized filters to know which ones are really worth worrying about. This is a great quote that I like very much by a colleague of mine, Dan Greer. In the world of network computers, every sociopath is your neighbor. I have a statistic on this. I'm big on statistics for calculating organically risk. There's a woman by the name of Stout, who's a behavioral psychologist at Harvard University, who's written a book called The Sociopath Next Door. In it, she has made the claim through her research that there are roughly 1 in 25, out of every 25 people, one is a sociopath. If there's a billion people on the internet, that means there's 40 million sociopaths out there, which is something I like to think about in the back of my mind to keep my paranoia levels up. I want to talk about the Agora for a minute. This is a local group, and I invite those of you who could attend from anywhere on the West Coast or even locally. There's another Agora meeting, and Agora is a collective of security professionals like Ernie and I who meet on a regular basis. It has a lot of beer drinking and private information exchange. It has no website. It has no information available on it. We have no entity that can be subpoenaed. We can't be FOIA'd. We just operate with trusted relationships. So we have just a lot of non-disclosure agreement signed amongst ourselves and a lot of trust. We're meeting on the University of Washington campus on December 2nd. If you'd like to attend to see what some of the subject matter might look like, I'll extend an invitation through it. But this is a very important aspect for critical infrastructure protection. For instance, Ernie and I, we told you we talked to people in Vancouver. I had close relationships with people in San Francisco and Portland and Long Beach and Los Angeles and San Diego. I know who those people are, and the commonality of our problems almost require mandate that we work together.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. We had at the port a couple months ago, it was on April 22nd, who was counting, right? We had a major attack on the port, which looked like a botnet attack. And we had all our machines started collapsing throughout the entire port. We had about 2,000 different workstations. Our servers started coming down and so forth. And I honestly thought it was a botnet attack because it happened right at 3:45 on a Friday afternoon in the port. Well, because of the Agora, I was able to immediately start calling people that, number one, I trusted, and number two, who knew their stuff. Number one is Dave Dietrich. Dave works here at the University of Washington, is faces on the cover of Information Security Magazine this month for his work on botnets. And Dave was one of the people I called to say, hey, help. Well, I met him through the Agora, and we have a trust relationship. Number two, I called Kirk up. Hey, Kirk, we got an issue coming on. Kirk got us connected with Microsoft through their essentially incident response team because of this trust relationship. Well, the good news is we figured out what the problem was. The bad news is it wasn't a botnet, but it was our antivirus vendor who was attacking us. It was, for those of you who are familiar with Trend Micro, it was their infamously bad pattern file they sent out that only shut down all your Windows XP Service Pack 2 boxes.
So, by the way, that automated attack that went out at that exact same time shut down trains in Japan and shut down, it caused lots of infrastructure disruptions.
Yeah, so it was huge. But now the weird part of this is that...
an update data
stream. Correct. And all of us were alarmed in the security community because we have charted scenarios. He's talked about conference rooms where you get people together to chart about what's possible. All of us have agreed that the perfect time to attack is late Friday afternoon on Pacific Coast Standard, Pacific Standard Time against the U.S. because most people are going to be gone. And the lights out are already on the East Coast and Central.
We thought it was a
planned attack.
It's probably a good case study, Mr.
When that happened, by the way, since I know they're a security company and stuff, but could they be prosecuted for violating, for doing a DDoS on you? Or on everybody?
That's a very good question. I mean, it was a worldwide denial of service attack, and but obviously it wasn't intentional. We are still talking to them right now about helping repay us, if you will, for some of the damages and so forth. But as far as prosecuting them, it might be difficult, mainly because they're a huge international company. Their headquarters in Japan. The actual patch came out of the Philippines. I don't know. I have to think about it.
They were worried. They were very responsive. And what was interesting is the Seattle response was the first one to really wake them up. We knew inside phone numbers of their engineers, and nobody could get through to Trend Micro because all their clients west of us were calling them like crazy. And so we were able to get into their response room first.
So let me ask Phil, what's your position on automatic updates?
We generally don't do it. We actually run everything through QA first. So one of the things we do for patches and antivirus updates, we have a 0.1% test machines, 10% QA, and then the rest of the environment. Because that's one of the things we're most nervous about, especially as you get to kind of more active tools like intrusion prevention, behavior control, where the control going crazy can do as much damage as the control's trying to do.
I think this is a subject we can all argue about. I arm wrestle at work all the time about whether we should download automatically or test it. And we're still automatically downloading in spite of this event.
The other thing we did recently is we started deploying some software from a company called Altiris, which is fast backout stuff. So in certain locations, we don't have to type, because of time zones, we don't have time to test, like Tokyo. And we just slam the stuff in there and use Altiris to switch it back within like a second if it breaks stuff.
Right. Yeah. This slide, I was checking when you were talking. You and I was harmonizing with you very closely over here. The traditional, classical ideas of risk management, as you said, don't work. And I asked, you can read all kinds of stuff. There is no formula for me. What I do use is the same organic thing. And what I do is I try to create principles of operation for myself that give me the best possible outcome of information. So what I do is I take the traditional thing he talked about, vulnerability, threats, and risk, and I try to understand those and then calculate risk in an entirely different way specific to the environment I'm in. But in order to do critical infrastructure, in order to play the game for getting grants and getting money to support this, and to talk to government management, you have to be you have to talk their language, and they require this kind of formalization. So I want to talk briefly about the current environment for critical infrastructure, the politics of them based on the vulnerabilities, threats, and risks. So go to the next one, Ernie. The vulnerabilities. This is just a quick slide to tell you what the problem is. The politics of technology are horrible for the CISO. you have elected officials in local institutions. There's 87,000 localities, all those mayors, all those executive county executives, all those borough chairpersons who their politics require that they provide services for their citizenry. Well, local governments are entirely underfunded. Their tax bases are bad mostly, and the economy is bad, it's even worse. And the politics of technology is terrible. There's this pervasive dream that politicians like to haul out that if we modernize, if we install technology and put all our services in an automated way and throw up web pages and do everything online, that they're going to look popular. And they have this whole issue of social issue of closing the generation gap. They want to make technology available to all their citizens. So there's this initiative to roll out technology. It's an alluring problem for the CISO because politicians don't want to listen to you because you have to naysay a lot of what they're talking about, because the true cost of deploying technology is very much higher than what they think, especially when it comes to critical infrastructure. It's very hard for me to talk to Seattle City Light or some of these other utilities. It's hard for a CISO to talk to any utility operator and say, you want to cut down your engineer costs by installing more automated tools so you don't have to have as many engineers, and you want to have more manual operations converted to automated operations, but the true cost of protecting the technology might be more than the engineers that are leaving, because you're going to have to hire specialists to control that environment. The vulnerability issues are extensive. When you combine lack of funding with large technology initiatives, you have enormous problems with security, especially for the infrastructure. And the politics are always can-do, and they have to be vetted and washed for public opinion. So it's an extraordinarily difficult problem. So the vulnerabilities are largely born out of money and politics, not technology. Cyber threats. The cyber threats are an interesting problem. I want to go through quickly two kinds of problems that face critical infrastructure. The first one is the terrorist threat. I'll tell you about that a little bit, and then I'm going to tell you about the larger threat right now for just enterprises in general and critical infrastructure, and that's criminal organizational threat, criminal organizations. Right after 9/11, the City of Seattle's risk committees and their insurance underwriters were shocked to see that the Insurance Services Office of New Jersey did a quick ranking of cities throughout the United States. They had this huge bill for New York, and they said, my God, what if we see more terrorist attacks? What are we going to do in terms of our underwriting risk? And so they got together and they formulated a whole new set of underwriting criteria and rated the cities. And Seattle, unfortunately, came up number 5 in the country, is the 5th most likely in Tier 2. What Tier 1 means is that these cities here are 100 times more likely to be targeted by terrorists for physical attacks or cyber multiplying attacks than any other one. We're in Tier 2, which is 20 times more likely, and we're in bed with Los Angeles, Houston, Philadelphia, and Boston. And how this figure translates, I can give you an example. The cost of doing business in the city went way up. Safeco Fields insurance to cover this kind of a thing went from $50,000 a year in 2001 to $500,000 a year in 2002. That means if you're a small business and you want to, or a business and you want to do this kind of risk underwriting, your costs go up.
Wouldn't the risk of a cyber attack be measured differently than the risk of a physical attack?
Yes, it would be. And as a matter of fact, that's a huge and interesting a problem for institutions. We have a real interesting thing going on here at the University of Washington. We have a very bright risk manager here at the University of Washington, and she is interested in the underwriting issues associated, the risk issues associated with the cyber threat. And I can tell you that there are some new policies coming out, largely around identity theft and the exposures for creating identity theft for the companies that might be at fault for that. They're starting to be written up, but they are different. And it's not as easily understood. And the reason I included all this criteria is because I can tell you that there are two things I learned to rely on as a security professional protecting critical infrastructure: intelligence indicators and my gut feel. I had a hair on the nap of my neck measure, you know, how bad did this sound? And based on it, and I neutralized how much I reacted to it by how much intelligence I gathered, which goes to this point I'm making about intelligence gathering, which we need to do more of as a security community. One of the things I did, and to show you how bad this is the Seattle is the only city that has ever taken time to try and create some kind of an analysis of what the cyber threat might be from terrorists to this locale in the state. The only thing that exists now for most local organizations, all 87,000 of them, are reports from the Department of Homeland Security that come down through the police department, through the police chief of police and the mayor, who are now usually given security clearances. Major cities are given security clearances. And I've had access to interpretations of those reports, and I can tell you that they don't say much. They're all so general. And the problem with generalized information was it was costing the city of Seattle a lot of information, a lot of money. For instance, when we go from yellow alert to orange alert, it would cost the city, I think, an extra police officers working overtime, protecting, and extra patrols on our dams and pipelines and other key facilities and service sets at like $100,000 a week. That's money the city doesn't have. So the question I posed to my contacts in Washington, D.C., which I got through Agora, was, is there any way we can get localized information so that we can respond to the orange elevation responsibly, but if we know that the threat is centric to the East Coast, maybe we don't have to deploy $100,000 a week. We can deploy $50,000 a week to save money. And one of the things that I decided to do is try to put together a group to do this intelligence analysis. And this report actually came out. It's protected under RCW. You can't get a copy of this. But I can tell you that what we did is we looked at 60 of the terrorist organizations by the State Department, identified by the State Department as terrorist organizations, did open source analysis of all the open source information we could find published around the world, and tried to decide based on the discoveries and the information we were able to get from all sources and rank the different organizations that are doing activity that may be related to cyber, what their potential for attacking the critical infrastructure in the Seattle and Washington State area would be. And we came up with some threat analysis. It was very interesting. And I used this as part of my responsibility, in my responsibilities of scoping and charting my strategic response for deploying what tools I was able to purchase. Very important to have this kind of information. And by the way, this was I vetted this with the intelligence community. They couldn't tell me things for sure, but you build relationships, and I shipped off copies of this to all my contacts in the intelligence community, and they sent back comments, and then basically reinforcing or giving me ideas where I might be wrong. So this had some legitimate value to it. And of course, this was shared with Washington State General Loewenberg and others. But this is the kind of information security professionals have to start getting into. You have to read everything.
Right. But this is what Kirk's also saying. This is not the traditional IT security job. This is a lot more to the right on that continuum that we're trying to show.
Right. And I only bring up this is an enormous problem for critical infrastructure, botnets and the zombie problems. And the reason it's a problem for us is it's energizing the criminal community. You were saying for yourself, they're getting more sophisticated. Their delivery systems, their targeting systems, their payloads are being financed now by organized crime, botnet delivery systems, and botnet usage. And these threats are becoming enormously problematic. Go ahead, next slide.
Okay, this week, a small botnet of 100,000 machines was shut down in Netherlands. That was a small one.
Right, the Dutch 100,000. And that's small. There are about 35,000 botnets being tracked by the local stateside CERT, U.S. CERT. Some of the botnets in that they're tracking are upwards of 750,000 to a million machines. This is just a quick listing of the spectrum, and this is the point I wanted to make. Crimeware, financial gain, is transforming the malware into more threatening and problematic issues for those of us protecting critical infrastructure. I want to talk a little bit about how the world looks. This is a tiny slice of crime. There is crime organizations going all over the country. This is some intelligence we gathered. Several of us got together over the last 6 months, and we produced an intelligence report on how large and how big the criminal activity is getting throughout the world, involving phishing and financial crimes, as well as some of the tools they're using. And this is just one set of groups that I analyzed, and I wanted to show you the geography of it, and how crimeware is starting to have a unique geography that makes investigating it and prosecuting it nearly impossible. This is something called Phishing Group 30, which is the anti-phishing groups in the financial industries are tracking some 56 phishing organized crime units. And they're an interesting source. They're not the only source, but they're an interesting source. I point to the Poppel Group because they have set a trend. They're one of the more successful ones, and they're vocal, and there's a lot of information about them. They're Phishing Group number 30. They are making, there are 15 of them, 12 to 15 people involved in the Poppel Group, which includes the Baltic Sea states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, some very talented people out of Belarus and Russia. This group, they're making $300,000 a month each. Each person in that group is making $300,000 a month, and they're doing that through phishing. Now they're converting to crimeware, which is different than phishing. Phishing is done through spamming and trying to socially engineer a good phishing scheme. If you launch it, it will take a week and you'll get 500 identities, people to respond, which you can use. With crimeware, you can get upwards of 20,000 a week because you just take over machines, mine the data, send it back, and you've got it. What's interesting about the Palka group is we know that some Russian groups have developed technology alchemy. You can take raw data and you can put it into programs they've built, and They turn on those programs, and a week later, money starts appearing in offshore accounts. And what those programs do are grab the data, like name, social security number, date of birth, credit card number, name, security code number, and the programs will create identities for them, make purchases for them on these identities, and have other false identities buy those, wash the money through cash-out schemes, and ship those monies offshore, all in an automated sort of way. What that means, the thing that's so bad, is that data has become a commodity. And now it's my new job at the University of Washington. It's a serious problem, because if data is a commodity, that means I have a whole other spectrum of threat associated with the commoditization of data instead of just protection of systems. We know that coders are for hire. They're kind of flamboyant right now, so you can track where they're coming from. There's some things about this map I'll point out quickly because we want to get through this stuff. Brazilians are the best at building crimeware. They're very good. The blessing right now is that they seem to only be harming Brazilians. They stay in nation size. And about $55 million this year. Worldwide, cybercrime last year was estimated by the FBI and McAfee at being $400 billion in revenues for these people. We know that there are coders coming out of the Philippines and out of Malaysia. We know that there's some very interesting relationships being built. Coders out of Switzerland are now teaming up with Romanians, who tend to be isolated, and it looks like they're building extortion schemes that are becoming very, very effective. We know that extortion schemes in offshore gambling areas in the Caribbean netted the Palka Group about $85 million in extortion fees for offsite gambling. Very profitable. The crimeware, it's such an easy way to make money. Organized, traditional organized international crime. You want to get with that? What's happened is that...
Can I just fill out another question? Can you say anything about the extortion event that you described?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really minor. I mean, it wasn't extortion. It was just kind of an attack, an electronic attack against us to try and dissuade us from doing certain types of business, which we weren't anyway. Like, we've not been hugely targeted by this stuff because of the nature of what we do.
What's targeted now are small businesses like offshore gambling, web gambling stuff.
And the threat is a DDoS attack or something like
that?
Yeah,
what they'll do, the pattern is this, you're operating, you're making $100,000 a week as an offshore gambling website. You're put out of business for about 5 hours, and you get the message, pay up, or you're going to be put up. And they just pay. It's cheaper to pay $20,000 to $30,000, maybe $100,000, so that they'll leave you alone. And if you don't, they can just take you off the internet.
There was a great article, I think it was CIO Magazine, had a terrific article about the Guatemalan or Nicaraguan extortion and how they went around that. But also this week in the news, there was an open source article I read that basically said some people are saying we're going to pay the extortion rather than fight the DDoS. It's just too expensive and too hard. Yes, sir.
Have they progressed to protection schemes yet?
Yes.
I mean, so you know,
Oh, you bet.
They'll protect you from other gangs.
You bet. I'm going to tell you something really weird. Some of us in the security, over several beers, some of those organized crime units want their bots so well preserved and operating so well, they fight to protect them. Zotop, you saw that. You saw a funny couple of kids out of Morocco and Egypt launch a worm that used an exploit, or was an exploit of a vulnerability that I know a criminal group wanted to use. And so these kids robbed this group of a pre-planned set of attacks that was worth millions. They created an extraordinary amount of variance. You got 13 Zotop variants inside of 13 hours or 24 hours. They went after, and what those variants were doing were coming in on Zotop were the criminal gangs putting these kids out of business and taking over the machines. So some of us have gotten the idea that maybe we need to manage our machines through parasitic control. Let well-known cyber criminals take over our devices. And we know that they'll protect it. They update them to make sure nobody else takes them. And if you know what that cyber criminal's doing, you can defend against that known existent threat instead of doing everything. Of course, it's after 4 beers. Maybe it'll be a 3-beer idea.
So we have 9 patches to get out between now and Friday.
Exactly. So anyway, the reason I bring this up is there's some real strong concern in critical infrastructure that very successful criminal enterprises that are technologizing themselves, making themselves all electronic, which are already starting to migrate up into the meth problems and into the prescription drug problems and into illegal drugs and into human trafficking, particularly prostitution and child porn, we're worried that the money laundering capability of these new criminal alchemy programs they have is going to become attractive to the terrorists. U.S. and international response to the terrorist threat has been to close off their money avenues, and other than the...
Yeah, there's the Hawalas. If you haven't heard about those, you might want to do some Google searches on the Hawala. Essentially, it's an ancient money movement scheme that comes out of the Middle East. And it's a trust act mechanism so that I go into a store, hand somebody $5,000, and then the equivalent in rupees shows up in Pakistan the next day. And it's an amazing scheme that this is where most of the money is moving. And it's also being moved in electronics, commerce, and technology commerce.
So what we're worried about is that new alliances get formed between terrorist organizations. And like I said, there's a whole bunch of them. They will decide to solve their money problems by teaming up with cybercrime gangs and start moving money through new business alliances. And there's no way to track and trace the money going through these right now. So all of a sudden, Osama bin Laden, instead of disrupting traditional Islamic financial stuff, which is sacred, he can now team up with criminals, cyber criminals, and move millions of dollars quickly through the cyber underground of the criminal alchemy, which is a very interesting problem for us. So we're on high alert for the potential problem of that kind of funding. Or, worse, cyber gangs realizing there's money to be made in extortion on a larger scale. The next one. Ernie and I are going to talk very quickly about these, but on the watch, on Ernie's and my watch, we have been, the city and the port have been active in multiple scenario testing exercises funded by the federal government and done locally. We did something called Top Off 2. You probably heard about that. That was a rat explosion where we had all the first responders about 2 years ago respond, and we had the hospitals engaged, the University of Washington hospitals engaged, and we simulated a radioactive dirty bomb explosion. Well, simultaneous with that, about $2 million was spent creating a cyber exercise to see what would happen, how that attack could be, the effect of it could be multiplied with a force multiplying cyber attack. And we actually did a very complex exercise. We did the same sort of thing with Livewire. This was funded out of Dartmouth. Actually, the CIA funded this through Dartmouth, through a grant. And they were interested in a more granular study of the force multiplier attack by technology. We actually exercised that in the city of Seattle. And the Agora group was actually involved testing a variety of other counter tools, attack back tools. Ernie, we're talking
and
about
Blue Cascades 2, if you haven't heard of it, was like last November, and it was about 350 different agencies representing the Pacific Northwest and the Western Canada. And what we did is we went through a tabletop scenario of a cyber attack followed up by a physical attack, with a cyber attack affecting the communications capabilities of the first responders. And so as you walk through the event, you realize, I can knock out 800 megahertz, I can knock out telecom, I can knock out email, I can knock out a few other things. So now when you get a first responder on the scene, they can't talk, they can't ask for help, they can't do a lot of things. So it was really a pretty interesting exercise.
What was interesting about all of these exercises is that we were all worried about them attacking the actual telecommunications infrastructure, and it turns out in most attack plans it makes no sense for the adversary to disrupt the telecommunications infrastructure, like the carrier hotels, where there's the concentrated technology in geographical regions. It makes more sense to keep the technology available to allow more access, more accounted for their own command and control communications. So we found out some very interesting things. Some of it you can't hear about because it's classified, but we've learned a lot in the long run. The last one was a very interesting exercise. This points to the Agora, which goes to networking. Networking is one of the most important things you can do, building trusted relationships. I say it again, which isn't in any security textbook. But what happened when I first arrived in the city of Seattle, I had all this critical infrastructure, and I quickly realized I didn't know how to protect it. So what I did was make a call to the Agora and ask every expert who knew how to defend critical infrastructure if they would come to the city of Seattle and run some vulnerability analysis for me. So what we did is we created an atlas of the city, all the technology of the city, all of its critical infrastructure, all of its underlying IP technology, and we put that atlas down in front of five teams, about 20 people per team, experts from around the country, the NSA cyber attack team, who did the risk analysis of the potential loss of the EP when the EP5 went down in China. These are the people that go after infrastructure for the U.S. We had JTFCNO, military people. We had all kinds of experts from CIA, NSA, all come in, as well as lots of corporate professionals, like Mr. Venable, come in and help us out. And we had five areas of interest. What kinds of long-term vulnerabilities exist for long-term disruption? What kind of vulnerabilities exist that can be exploited for short-term disruption? What vulnerabilities can be exploited to undermine people's faith in their local government? Trust attack. And the last one was the ability to kill people directly or indirectly through technology. Anyway, we completed that exercise and came up with a whole variety of very interesting conclusions in a 3-day intensive. It was 24 hours a day, 3 days. And we came up with some very interesting vulnerability exposures. And this was an organic analysis. It was a practical analysis that yielded a tremendous amount of information. Again, all that information is protected under RCW. Ernie, you want to talk just a little bit about
that? Well, I think that the key elements we're trying to raise here, and we're almost finished because we're like 3 minutes over, is number one, if you want to be a security professional, especially in a cyber environment, a couple of things to recognize, and I think Mr. Venables also raised this quite well, is you're in a hot seat. I mean, I tell you, every day it's something new. It's if you look at the emails that Kirk and I and all of us get, it's a wide range of issues, and almost every one of them is a little bit of a crisis point. Look, like this week with the patches coming out from Microsoft, there's all sorts of talk around on the internet and in other channels basically saying there's a prediction for an attack on Friday. Well, is that true or not? I don't know, but I've got 200 and some odd servers that I've got to be patched. Kirk's even in worse shape from the university. You can have an impact on people's lives. What if you're doing an investigation on an email issue or a pornography issue or whatever? I mean, you may actually wind up having someone terminated. That is not fun, but it's also part of the job description. You're subject to background checks. Kirk and I have both gone through police-level background checks. I did it at the Port of Seattle, Kirk did it at the city, and also here at the UW. It's complete checks for felonies, felony convictions, polygraphs, the whole works.
Financial backgrounds, relationship stuff.
And the adversary. The adversary can be anybody. It's really sort of a bizarre thing. I mean, it's almost like... once you start getting involved in this arena, you can also be one of the bad guys, and because the bad guy doesn't like you.
The adversary is an interesting problem. In 25 years I've been a security professional, I've been threatened 5 times. And the problem with the new adversary is, in some of the scenarios we ran, one of the things to do is to isolate and disrupt the lives of key defenders, which can be documented in reconnaissance actions by the adversary. So there's some interesting problems if you're interested in the field that are emerging. Just a caution that we throw out for people.
It's funny, me and three of my team have had personal death threats from organized crime groups.
Yeah, I've had 2 death threats, and I tell you, it's a great way to ruin a Saturday morning.
Gee, I feel left out.
Yeah, so... the future, this is a very interesting field.
I've got to worry, I live in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah, we got the Ben Moses dad. Yeah. Let me kill him, he talks funny. the bit about the future, let me give you a statistic. We are desperate for talented people in this field. The more we can collaborate with talented people, the more we would like it. The estimate by the President's Commission on Critical Infrastructure Protection, which produced a report about the gap and where the U.S. needs to be to defend its critical IP infrastructure, said that it needed some 55,000 well-trained security professionals to defend the U.S. infrastructure in the next 10 years. Well, half of that time's gone by, and now we need about 60,000 to 70,000, I'm guessing, based on the inflation of the problem. We need that many trained security professionals defending the infrastructure of the U.S., and that includes the internal infrastructure of private sector organizations as well. It's an interesting future, and if you want to be on the cusp of interesting research that I think will start to be funded, I think this area has the bigger chance of getting more funding than others, truthfully.
Yeah, just for something interesting, if you wanted a subject for your term paper or whatever, I submit you just take a good hard look at spyware right now. Spyware and crimeware. I've actually had to do a presentation to some folks at the port and just sat down and read about seven or eight white papers on the weekend. And the more I read, the more it bothered me, because it is so bizarre and so hard. That's why spam's going down. Spam isn't where you make the money anymore. It's to do the spyware.
Right. Criminal enterprise can be read in spam levels. Spam was spiking at 90% of traffic on occasion, and now it's down to an average of about 70%. And that's because the fishers I talked about, the PALCA groups, the fishing groups are moving from spam to crimeware, which is really uncomfortable. So that's it. If you have any questions...
Let's take a few questions, sir.
Some companies restrict their employees to only a few websites. Does the City of Seattle or the Port of Seattle do that, or is it useful?
We use a program called WebSense, and it basically has updates coming in from the WebSense company that says here's the pornography sites or the hate sites or whatever that we're basically blocking. And then I also use that as a tool almost as an outbound filter. So, for example, if we know like emoticons, we had these emoticon problem with these smiley faces on emails and so forth, and just because of where it was coming from, it was easier for us to turn it off there than it was going through firewalls and everything else. But we use that all the time. And we also use that for managers suspects an employee's been spending way too much time on the internet or whatever. If there's an appropriate request through human resources, comes to us, we'll do a research to see what time, how much time they're spending on it.
City doesn't feel.
And I used to work for a company which was involved in the ports container tracking. And a few years back, there was a, I mean, since there is no system for the customs or the law enforcement to test the containers. So if you say a container has openers, and you have to believe that or open the container, I mean, it might have bones for all you know.
Yeah, there's actually a thing called CKPAT. I forget what it stands for now, but essentially it's going back to the source where the containers are loaded and starting to do documentation and inspections there. The problem is it's very hard to follow a ship under a cloud in the middle of the ocean where it might intercept another ship and exchange containers or move goods in and out.
So presumably your company has a, you have no privacy employment agreement, is that right?
Yeah, people sign away the ability for us to surveil their entire lives.
Right.
The only exception you get though is actually there's some, particularly European countries, where privacy legislation overrides other legislation, and there's other legislation like securities regulation where you require to surveil financial transactions. The conflict with their own privacy. You're faced in this choice in some cases of having to pick which law you comply with. And you know, you go speak to the regulators in the European Union and they're pointing at each other, which is kind of annoying.
And our appropriate use policy basically says that everything on a port asset is free and clear for us to surveil and look at. And not that we do that, but the point is that this is not called, or your machine is not called a personal computer, it's called a workstation, because there's nothing personal about it. You can leave things on here like your resume and the last job you looked at in Monster, but I suggest you don't do that.
Other questions here?
Just a kind of overall question, like, how do you calculate the return on investment in something like this, right?
I'm very prejudiced. There's no return on investment for security. It's an insurance policy. And my industry has this thing going on, and I'm very angry with it. There is no ROI on security except it's smart business, period. There's no, you can't calculate that.
Well, one of our very close friends up in Canada, a security professional there, calls ROI as risk of incarceration.
Yeah.
So you can use that as a rule of thumb.
Any San Diego questions?
Doesn't look like it.
How about Berkeley?
No.
Microsoft. We done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lose one person in the back.
Wait, one more question.
You say we need like 70,000 cybersecurity professionals in the next 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And Ed brought up earlier this problem that you know, the DHS is only funding classifiers, or DARPA is only funding classified security. You've gone through a taste of that here, right? Giving us, you know, a great presentation, but there's all this, we want to know specifics. There's all this stuff that's classified. So how do you get 70,000 cybersecurity professionals nationwide if the way that you learn about things is over beer?
Yeah. Drink a lot of beer? Maybe?
Well, you know, you make a very good point. There is a there are a couple of families in the security industry, and one is it doesn't chart, as professionals, we've not charted a good career path or training program.
Right.
And it's, we're trying to do that now with programs like what's going on here.
But in all seriousness, if you were to look across the U.S., I can't speak for Canada, but I would say that of all the places in the U.S. that you had to be if you wanted to be a security professional, it's probably the best place in the world right here. Because we've got some phenomenal organizations like the Agora, the leading edge programs like at the University of Washington, NSA Center for Excellence for Security. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. And if you were to even look at Information Security Magazine, it's strictly a kind of a bellwether, or CSO Magazine. On the cover for like every other month is somebody from the Pacific Northwest. I mean, as a security professional who's seen as a superstar or a professional.
That's it. I think you're out of time.
Good time. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Sorry.